This is Startups for the Rest of Us, episode 32. Welcome to Startups for the Rest of Us, the podcast that helps developers be awesome at launching software products, whether you've built your first product or are just thinking about it. I'm Mike.
And I'm Rob.
And we're here to share our experiences to help you avoid the same mistakes we've made. How you doing this week, Rob?
Doing pretty well. I'm looking forward to the Thanksgiving holiday next week. I'm going out of town for a week, so kind of gearing down for that, getting ready to go into holiday mode. Sales always are kind of treacherous in some of my businesses during November and December, just because people are off a lot, and so certainly no sales the week of Christmas, and often lower sales levels in Thanksgiving.
So you just decide to heck with it and throw
cash
in the shop.
Yeah, I'm going to be out of town for a month. I'll see you in January.
Very nice.
How about you? What's going on? Anything new?
Well, I have a couple of things. I mean, I'm still working on that database that I talked about in our last podcast. I've come to the realization that I think I actually need a third database, not just two. I think I need three now. And all three of them need to be a little bit different because of the information that I'm storing. For today's episode, we actually have a guest on today, our first guest ever. So today we have Harry Hollander from Moreware Software on here. How are you doing, Harry?
Doing pretty well. How about you?
Not too bad. Well, Rob and I kind of already introduced what we're up to. What about you? What are you up to?
Just working hard, still full of great ideas from that Business of Software conference. So we're trying to do all kinds of new products and new ways of dealing with the existing customers that we have.
Very cool.
To give people some background, I met Harry at the 2009 Business of Software conference. And then he and I emailed and just had some chats over the course of the past year. And then Mike met him this year, and Harry and I kind of caught up over the past year, and I met his business partner and everything. So we really wanted to bring Harry on because he actually had some ideas for a topic, as well as certainly some good input that I think will be beneficial to everybody.
Well, I was hoping I could just ask you guys the question and then you'd come up with all the answers.
I was going to leave that part out. Yeah. So Harry, to really give you the detail, Harry emailed me and said, hey, would you guys be, you know, interested in discussing this on the podcast? We've just gone through all this stuff and I think it might be beneficial. And so I told Mike, I said, hey, free content. Harry could come on and share all his info because he's done all this stuff. It's going to be more of a typical kind of discussion. And Harry's just another participant.
So for today's episode, we're going to talk about some of the professional services that you may need for your business. We expect that this podcast is probably going to go long, so we're going to edit it probably about halfway through. We'll post it as two different podcast episodes. We'll make sure that we try and cover everything that we possibly can. So the first professional service that we wanted to talk about is getting an attorney. One of the most common startup questions that people have is, do I need an attorney up front? And second is, where would I find one? And my feeling on it is, I personally don't really shop around for attorneys. I've used a couple over the past few years, but I've also lived in a couple of different states. So depending on what my needs were at the time, I just kind of looked around to find somebody that would suit my needs. I didn't really look over the internet, though. I know that that's certainly a viable option, and most developers are probably going to turn to that. But what I do is I got a recommendation from somebody who lived in my area who could actually help with some business stuff, because you really want somebody who's comfortable with the local laws. So I live in Massachusetts, and if, for example, I went down to Connecticut or Rhode Island, the attorney that I came up with would probably not necessarily know all of the laws that are specifically applicable to Massachusetts. Similarly, some people decide that they want to set up a Delaware corporation for tax purposes. And that also leads to challenges when getting an attorney, because then you have an attorney who's basically out of state and you have to figure out what laws are applicable to your business, because most of your business is probably going to be done in the state that you live in, not necessarily where the company is incorporated in. So, as I said, what I did was I basically asked some people that I knew, just decided to find somebody that I liked, and the attorney that I have bills me at about $250 an hour. And it's a lot of money, but at the same time, it can also save you a great deal of grief if you find somebody that you're comfortable working with. And over the years, I've gotten to the point where I actually don't need to talk to my attorney very often. Occasionally, I'll come up with an off-the-wall or obscure question for him, but generally, he just kind of turned me loose at one point and said, hey, look, you know what? You really don't need to be paying me for this stuff. You actually know it pretty well.
So my situation's been a little different. I've been in business for about 8 years, and I just got an attorney about a year ago when I moved back to California. I was a sole proprietor before that, and I would always just file my own paperwork and do whatever it took to get the legal stuff done. So my feeling, obviously, is that, you know, you don't need an attorney up front. And I even had a couple partnerships, and we put together the agreements ourselves. Of course, you should have an attorney review these agreements, but in our cases, we didn't. Now, moving forward, I got an attorney about a year ago when I moved back to California, and I went to the local business incubator. It's a nonprofit here in Fresno, and they are trying to spur, you know, high-tech growth and other business activities. And so I went to the head of that, a guy named Travis, and I said, hey, is there a lawyer here who basically caters to tech startups? And there is. There's a local guy. He's a great lawyer named Ryan Corrigan. He is my lawyer. And the thing I like about him is that he really understands the entrepreneurs, and he understands that cash is a kind of a big issue for most of them. And he also, it's cool because he's like a solopreneur. He's like virtual. And so he doesn't have an office, and he meets wherever you want. We met at a Starbucks, and he basically just asked the right questions. He was quick. Everything's electronic. There wasn't faxing back and forth. It was all scanned. And he said, I don't want originals. Shred the originals. You know, it's just this cool feeling of like, I feel like this is the way law is going to go. And he told me he doesn't have filing cabinets at home. Everything's digital. So anyways, that's kind of been my experience with it. So how about you, Harry?
We started also about 7 or 8 years ago. And at that time, we were living in the Bay Area. And so there's a big infrastructure there for all of the tech startup related services. So we actually had quite a few tech-specific lawyers that we talked to and kind of interviewed based on recommendations from friends who had gone through it before. And we found a group of guys that we really liked, and it was a small practice. Actually, a few years ago, they sold out to a giant law corporation. So now our lawyers is some, you know, huge international law firm. And so it's kind of weird now. The personal attention that we really wanted and we were getting beforehand is kind of gone. But I still feel like if in the future we want to do more fancy stuff with our business, we have that opportunity because now, you know, there's hundreds of lawyers that work at the same firm that we use. But I'm still skeptical of the whole thing because we met the guys that we actually originally worked with. But I think the way it happens now, and we don't have a lot of legal needs, is that I talk to the associate or usually just email back and forth. And then all of the stuff we need just magically gets done. And I get an email back saying, okay, we did whatever.
Yeah, that's an interesting situation. Are you guys thinking of sticking around for now because you have the relationship with those guys, or are you thinking about looking around for other counsel?
We don't have a lot of needs for a lawyer. Typically, what we have them do is, you know, if we do a new license agreement or something like that, just run it by them. And then we do our corporate annual report. We file that with them because that's something you're supposed to do. And beyond that, we don't have a lot of expenses with our lawyer. So it's probably not worth the effort of trying to change.
Right. That makes sense. I have a question for both of you guys. What are your thoughts on just in professional services in general? I've had CPAs and, well, a lawyer and other people, and some of them I like them as a person, and others of them I more respect what they do, but I get the feeling like we're not quite on the same wavelength. Like we wouldn't enjoy having a conversation at a party, or we wouldn't hang out outside of, you know, a professional relationship. What do you guys think in terms of how much do you need to like the person you are dealing with?
When we first started working with our lawyer, I thought he was being rude to me by only responding in emails and leaving, you know, really short messages for me or having really quick conversations. And then I realized he was doing us a service because they charge by the hour or by the 7.5 minute increment. And so having, you know, just fast interaction with them turns out to be valuable for us, right? It saves us money. Based on the original interview, I know they seem to be upfront, honest guys, but there's not as much of the ongoing relationship because I think they're doing us a service by trying to keep it short.
Got it. That makes sense.
I could see myself hanging out with my attorney, to be perfectly honest. I mean, he's a cool guy. He actually tells lawyer jokes, which is funny. I've worked with him through a couple of different things, and I think you probably get a really good sense of how well you meshed with your attorney based on, you know, some situation that comes up that is not necessarily beneficial towards you, and, you know, how he treats you and how he responds to your needs and everything. And I've gone through that with my attorney, and he was extremely helpful, very responsive. And, you know, I couldn't possibly thank him enough. I mean, he easily saved me. I won't put a number on it, but it was a huge headache, and he certainly came through for me. So I've stuck with him for a long time. And the reason is because I'm very comfortable with him and we're on the same wavelength. We understand where each other is coming from. And he has no problem if I disregard his advice, as long as I understand that I am disregarding his advice.
Yeah, I think there's a lot to be said for having a long-term relationship with someone. There's a lot of things that go unspoken after a while. You know, I think with an accountant especially, I've really found value in having one for a long time, because it feels like every year they just understand your business a little more. So speaking of accountants, that's actually our next professional service. And by the way, we're going to be talking about 5 in total. So this is number 2 of 5. The questions we're going to discuss is, do you need an accountant early on? You know, when you first start, where do you find one? And should you use a private one-man shop or more of a CPA firm? And in my experience, I did not have one up front. As I said, I was a sole proprietor, and so all of my income and expenses just went right into my personal income taxes. And for the first few years, I used Quicken to do my taxes, and so it all just went in there, and it was no problem. As things got more complicated, and as I realized that I could actually save on taxes by restructuring some things, then it was worth, you know, hiring a CPA. And I did that probably 5 years ago now. Yeah, I don't think you need a CPA from day one. I don't think there's enough complexity. When you get to the point where it's so complicated that, you know, you feel a little overwhelmed that first year, that's when I would think about hiring someone. In terms of where to find them, it's like anything else. It's like getting a recommendation. I can't imagine going to the phone book or even the internet and just searching for a local accountant. I got both of my accountant recommendations. One was from the lawyer here in Fresno, and then the accountant I had in Los Angeles was from a mortgage broker who had, you know, I had worked with to buy some real estate. And what the last piece was, should you use a private one-man shop or a CPA firm? I don't have any feelings on this. I've used, both of mine have been very small family-owned shops, and so they've been maybe 2 partners or 3 partners, and they're either related or they've known each other for years. So I don't know that I have much, you know, opinion or even understanding of kind of how the difference between a small shop and a firm might be.
So when we were first starting out, I actually got really good advice from a friend of mine, which is, don't worry about an accountant until you have money. So, you know, I think that was a wise choice looking back at it. So once we finally did have some money, because there were 2 of us, and at the beginning we were already in 2 different states, we knew that we were going to have complexity. And now our company spread out over 4 different states. And it turns out that dealing with taxes and where to collect taxes and, you know, all of the stuff related to having a corporation is more complex than either Ted or I want to deal with. It's just a lot of headache, and you never know if you're doing it right. So having an accountant is a no-brainer for us. We talked to a couple one-man shops, and neither of us had the confidence that they knew the ins and outs of things specific to dealing with software. So when we started our company, we sold kind of traditional software, and it turned out we had to collect sales tax in certain states and not others. When we switched to our subscription model, you know, where you have to collect tax is completely different. And I feel like because we're with a bigger firm and the guy that we deal with is completely specifically devoted to dealing with software companies, he really has a good understanding of what should apply to us and what doesn't.
And just to give people a little bit of background, if you're curious, Harry, you know, founded MoreAware Software. And if you want to check out his company, it's MoraWare.com. It'll also be in the show notes. But they essentially make scheduling software for the construction industry.
That's right.
I've been using a CPA for probably about 10 years or so now. I started using a CPA about 10 or 11 years ago, mainly because it is exactly what you said, Rob. My taxes started to get so complicated that it just wasn't worth my time. And I distinctly remember the day that I sat down and I figured, I'm like, oh, I've got a whole Saturday. I'll just bang out my taxes in a couple of hours. Well, 10 hours later, I was nowhere close to even being done. So I just kind of threw in the towel at that point and said, it's time for me to just go out and get a CPA. And part of it was because I was doing all these different things that had tax implications. Like I was doing day trading at the time. I had a business. I had a couple of different jobs that I had worked at. And it just got so complicated. It just was not worth the time and effort. And I'm sure I could have figured it out. I just didn't want to.
All I can say is that no matter what the cost is, if I had to do all of that stuff myself, I would definitely go crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah. So the bottom line here is if you get into a situation where you're looking at your taxes and it just seems like it's really complicated, go out and get help. I mean, it will be worth the money that you pay.
Yeah, I agree. And I think you brought up a good point. There was a day for me as well where I sat down and I spent 6 or 8 hours. And then it was like, there's just no way I'm going to finish this ever. You know, it's going to be like 3 more weekends. And it becomes stupid to do it yourself. I imagine everyone comes to that point, and that's when you should go out looking.
So as our next topic, we're going to talk about payment processing. The reason I brought this up to Mike and Rob is we recently changed merchant accounts for our credit card processing. And if you don't know anything about this, there's a couple all-in-one processors like PayPal and ToCheckout. And those probably would have worked for us with the business model that we have now. But when we were first starting out, we had no credit history or anything. And we were selling a really expensive software package. At the time, it was, I think, $5,000 or $6,000. And so PayPal and ToCheckout weren't appropriate at all for us. So we went with a merchant account. So there's a couple different layers of what you have to deal with when you're trying to find a credit card processor if you don't go with one of the all-in-one processors. Basically, there's the bank itself. So that's the merchant account. On top of that, most of the banks don't sell directly to other companies. So there's some sales organization that's going to sell you the services. And kind of layered on top of that is the gateway. So actually the website that you use to enter the transactions or the API that you use to talk to your software to do it automatically. And between all those things, and it seems like there's middlemen in between each of those layers too, everyone taking a cut, and nobody tells you their prices or tells you what's going on. So I feel like when we did it originally, we filled out a couple applications, and even though they can't tell you the prices, they give you kind of a range. And we went with the one that seemed like the best deal at the time. Because it's so painful to do, it took us years to look at changing that. And we changed it 6 months ago and dramatically reduced the rates that we spend for credit card processing. I heard an interview on Mixergy right after we switched about a service called Fee Fighters. And basically, they work with a bunch of credit card processors that have open pricing, so you can actually get a kind of comparison. And I would have loved to have heard about that before. So that's kind of been our experience, and I still don't feel very satisfied with what we ended up with because there's just no way to compare the apples and oranges of how much things are going to cost.
Yeah, I have to agree with you. As you said, I mean, it's just such an opaque process, and there's so many things that they don't tell you. And unless you really know what to look for, it's hard to know whether or not you're getting screwed. And I'm sure you ran into that as well. Was there like a massive price difference between what you're paying now versus what you were paying?
Oh, yeah. There was a huge difference. And I think because part of the difference was now we actually have a history as a business and we have more options. I think at the beginning, fewer people were willing to talk to us because we had this high price tag on an unproven company. So we were a high credit risk. That might not be the case for most people who are starting web startups. In general, it's a lower transaction cost and higher volume. So you can build up that history a lot faster. But it's just impossible to know what the prices are. You get this range, and then you don't even know once you start getting charges, what the charge is going to be for any particular transaction.
Yeah, I think that's always what bugged me the most, is that even from one charge to the next, it seems like the payment that you're making to the credit card processor changes from, you know, even one day to the next. It just seems kind of ridiculous. And like I said, they don't explain anything, so it's just hard to know whether or not you're getting screwed. I mean, I've had probably 3 or 4 different merchant accounts over the years, and the process is really no different. And, you know, I've gone with different vendors different times. It just doesn't matter. I mean, and some of them say, well, you have to use our software, or you have to buy our equipment in order to be able to do credit cards. And as soon as they start telling you those things and you say, well, I don't swipe credit cards, I do everything over the web, you can start eliminating some of those people because you know that they just don't have any experience in that arena. And if they don't have experience there, then they can't really help you nearly as much as somebody else who does have the experience could help you.
I am a diehard PayPaler, and I know that there are some people out there who are going to scream no and shake their fist at this as I say that. You know, there are horror stories from PayPal. There are horror stories for every merchant account processor. I mean, there's no doubt in my mind that I don't think any of them are, you know, much better or much worse. I've been using PayPal since very early days. Knock on wood, I've never had problems. I've never had funds seized or money locked up. I have multiple PayPal accounts. I pay them a car payment in commissions every month in fees. I mean, so much of my business goes through these different PayPal accounts. And while they're definitely not perfect, getting set up for a new credit card account, like to get the, you know, they are the merchant account and the gateway, is like clicking a button and waiting 24 hours for approval. And I had never realized how much of a pain it is to get approved otherwise. And until, boy, it was probably 4 or 5 months ago, I hadn't gone through the merchant account gateway process with another processor. And that was a fiasco. And it took about 8 weeks. And they kept rejecting me for ridiculous, in my opinion, ridiculous reasons and not telling me that I was rejected. So they would just say, all right, you'll hear from us in a few days. And then I would hear nothing. And then 2 weeks later, I would call them or, you know, I think I would call them and they would say, well, you offer gift certificates because this is for the wedding toolbox site. That's why I had to sign up for it because it works against Authorize.net's API. So I couldn't use PayPal without rewriting it. And they said, oh, yeah, you accept gift certificates. And I said, well, of course, it's a wedding website, blah, blah, blah. Yeah, well, we can't support that. And I said, well, it would have been nice. Could you email me and tell me that so that I could look for someone else? So then sure enough, they recommended another provider. And I went with them and same exact thing happened. They just never got back to me. And 2 weeks later, I call them and they're like, yeah, we rejected you. And it was because you offer a plan because someone can pay 18 months in advance because the websites are fairly cheap, right? You're setting up a wedding website. It's like $80 to pay for 18 months worth. And they said, we can't have that much liability because people could do chargebacks for 18 months. And I was like, for crying out loud, people, this business has been in business for 3 or 4 years. They've never had a chargeback, blah, blah, blah. So on and on. Eventually, it did. It took me about 2 months, and it probably took me a total of about 12 hours of my time, which, you know, I value pretty highly. And eventually, I got it. And it's twice as expensive as the PayPal equivalent. It's between 55 and 60 bucks a month minimum charge. Whereas the PayPal Web Payments Pro is like 30 bucks a month, which again, I always thought, man, that's kind of expensive. But now I'm realizing really how good I had it, you know, or how good I have it with my other sites. Once I have some time, I'll probably rewrite this site to use the PayPal Web Payments Pro and cancel the merchant account. But for now, I'm stuck with it. I know some people have problems with PayPal, you know, and they run into issues, but I really think that it's a good thing. I think it's brought flexibility and allowed a lot of web startups to, frankly, get off the ground pretty easily using it rather than having to go through this brutal merchant account process.
I think the really important thing to keep in mind is that there's this threshold that you kind of have to get over before going with a merchant account is really worth it. I mean, you have to be doing probably at least $10,000 in revenue every month in order to make a full-blown merchant account worth it over something like PayPal or TwoCheckout or something like that. Because even though the percent transaction rate may be quite a bit higher for either PayPal or TwoCheckout, the fact of the matter is that when you get a merchant account, there are, as Rob said, a minimum fee. And that minimum fee is usually around $55 to $60. And it depends on which one you go through. But there's usually a statement fee of some kind. And then there's a gateway fee, which is usually around $25. And then there's that minimum charge fee, which, you know, if the statement fee is $10 a month, you've got the gateway of $25. And then tack on another $20 for the other stuff.
And then there's $20 for the salesman wanted a latte fee.
Oh, yes.
It's ridiculous. Man, I look at this statement, I'm like, what are these? It's absurd, honestly, because up front it was like, yeah, it's $9.95 plus some fees. And I was like, oh, that's not too bad. And then it just, like Harry said, it seems like there's like five middlemen and they all take something up front. And then there's this fee every month that I'm paying to a bunch of people. It's pretty crazy. It's a very fragmented industry.
Yeah, it seems like the best thing about having PayPal there as an option is that at least if you were starting out today, that PayPal or TwoCheckout, one of those is what you would start with. And then ultimately, when you have a high enough transaction volume, you'd switch over to one of these, you know, more painful but slightly cheaper services.
Yeah, that's what I think. And I think, you know, I think Amazon Payments and Google Checkout, if you're doing all back-end kind of API integrations, I think both of those could handle it as well. So there are more options today, certainly than when you got started, what, 6 or 7 years ago.
So Rob, aren't you worried about being locked into just a single provider for the payment processing?
I think the reason I'm not concerned about it is because I have so many different websites, and if they jacked my rate up, I would then go and find a merchant account, and it would be pretty easy for me to migrate these websites to that merchant account. I could very well pretty easily go with Amazon or Google checkout with, you know, in a weekend, basically. Yeah. So I guess I'm not worried about it. I think with as much business as I do with them, I get like priority something. I get priority support. And I also get phone calls when they have new, they like called me because they have a new beta subscription model going on and they wanted me to try it out. So I would hope that I'm in their good graces enough that, you know, they aren't going to hose me, but it's a good point. If they did it, I would definitely think about switching. One thing I did learn is that PayPal, pretty sure they're not FDIC. They're not an FDIC establishment. And so I don't actually leave a lot of money in those accounts because in theory, you know, I guess if they went out of business or something that they're not FDIC insured.
Yeah, I think the big thing that I don't necessarily like about PayPal is the fact that when you link it up to your bank account, they can literally reach into your bank account at any time and take whatever they feel like out of there. And I have heard of, I'll call it a quote-unquote scam, because basically the way it would work is, if, and I don't remember all the specifics about it, but if somebody sends you money and then they ask you to send it back to them for any reason, as opposed to doing a refund if you turn around and send it to them. Well, if they didn't have the money to begin with for any reason or their payment source was rejected, it's very possible for you to end up with a negative balance and not know it, even though you received $400 for example, and you sent somebody $400, you don't realize right away that that initial payment to you had been rejected and it gets basically taken back. So, you know, there's certainly scenarios where that can happen, but I think that realistically that could happen with a merchant account as well. I mean, if somebody does a chargeback after you've delivered goods or services, then you're kind of in the same situation.
Yeah, I think my recommendation is to go with PayPal unless there's a compelling reason to do otherwise. And that'd be my thought. If you're a web startup just getting started, like Harry said, if you're selling something for $6,000, there's a compelling reason maybe to not go with PayPal. But most of the people listening to this are probably not going to be doing that.
Well, that makes a lot of sense to me. I think if we were starting with the business that we have today, 7 years ago, we probably would have started with PayPal just because it's such a low risk to get started with it. The way it works now is it's just a couple clicks and you're in. And that's incredibly compelling.
So the next professional service that we wanted to talk about that you may need for your business is insurance. There are several different types of insurance, and the one that we kind of wanted to talk a little bit more about was probably the one that you might know a little bit less about, and that's called professional liability insurance. What professional liability insurance covers is the services and goods that you offer. Now, this is a little bit different than your generic business insurance, which would cover your business property. So if, for example, you go out and you lease some office space, generally you need to have some sort of insurance on your assets that you will then essentially sign some paperwork that will authorize the building that you're occupying as what's called an additional insured. Now, what that does is if your computer or your server catches on fire overnight while it's there and it burns the building down, well, your insurance, your business insurance, will cover them. Well, what happens if your software goes haywire on somebody's machine and wipes it or wipes a domain controller or something along those lines? You can certainly end up in a situation where somebody will sue your business. And at that point, what you will need is you'll need professional liability insurance, because your business insurance does not cover things that you have delivered for the goods or services. And that's kind of the dividing line. Professional liability is for goods and services you offered. And then there's the general business insurance, which covers your business property.
Yeah, the way we went through this process of getting professional liability insurance just recently, and the way the insurance guy explained it to me is that if there's a physical good, then you're dealing with general liability insurance. And if it's just monetary value, so you're hurting someone's business for dollars, that's when professional liability insurance is important. So the part that stumped me about this is that general liability insurance is easy to get and it's pretty transparent in terms of what you're getting and what the typical things are. Professional liability insurance, and I still have the application sitting on my desk next to me here. I have a 15-page application for the Chubb Insurance Company asking the nitty-gritty of every aspect of our business, and I have no idea what I'm even supposed to tell them or not tell them. And when I got the quotes back from them and several other people that provide professional liability insurance, I was just shocked that the cost of that is like 10 times as much as if my software were to blow up a building or kill someone. And so I don't understand that for most web startups, how do you afford this kind of thing? We're lucky enough in the position that we feel like we have some money to protect, so it's worth the price of getting professional liability insurance. But I have no idea when it's appropriate, and I feel like something we probably should have done years ago and just never got around to doing.
I think that's the blessing and the curse of success, right? Is that the blessing is, you know, you've made money at this business, and now the curse is like, oh, we got to protect this from some screwball suing us or something, you know, because
right.
because it misscheduled his guys for one day. Because, I mean, that's the bottom line is someone can, you know, obviously sue you for any reason and you have to defend yourself. And that's a big deal. And I think that's where this insurance comes into play. I think to answer your question of, you know, when should a startup get this? My sense is always to essentially push it out until there's something worth protecting. If you start off as a sole proprietor and then you move into like an LLC or something that offers some liability protection, a corporation, then how much is in that corporation that is worth protecting? And it's like you said, if it's $10,000, $20,000 a year to get that liability insurance, then, but you don't have any money, you don't have any income in that corporation, then gosh, that doesn't make any sense. The part of the answer I don't know is, yeah, at what point does that make sense to do it? And I think an insurance salesman would tell you really, it's really early. And I think most startup people would say it's a lot later than you think.
I agree. I mean, I'm glad that we put it off just because it is so expensive. The cheapest quote we got for the things that we care about, which is our servers crashing and putting some of our customers out of business or our servers getting hacked. The cheapest quote for that was like $7,000 a year. At this point, it seems worth the price. But, you know, when we were first getting started, that would have been the number one expense for our whole company, which wouldn't have made any sense at all.
Yeah, I found that as well. When I went out and I got professional liability insurance, when I was running my consulting company, I had a partnership with Altiris Corporation, which was then purchased by Symantec. And I was required to carry professional liability insurance. And there was some specific dollar amount of insurance that I had to carry. And I forget exactly how much it was. But so I had to carry, you know, if anything happened, my insurance was on the hook first. So if I were going out and I were delivering services for NASDAQ or DuPont or whoever the customer was for Symantec that I was delivering services for at the time, if something went wrong, my insurance was on the hook first. And then if my insurance didn't cover it, then it would go to my umbrella policy. And then if that didn't cover it, then Symantec could get dragged into it. So, you know, there's all these different layers of insurance. And like I said, I was on the hook first, and justifiably so, because I was the one who was out there doing the work. And theoretically, I'm the one who screwed up. But you're right. I mean, it's very expensive. And if you don't have a solid revenue stream, then, you know, it's certainly not worth it. But in my case, I was required. It was one of those costs of doing business that had I not had the insurance, I couldn't do business.
So how did you decide on which insurance provider to use, or like what kind of package you even ended up with?
What I did was I actually went out and I found an insurance broker. And what an insurance broker does is they generally have relationships with a number of different insurance companies. And at the end of the day, if you start looking at the overall commercial market for insurance, and by commercial market, I'm not referring to like your car insurance and homeowners insurance. Those are one particular type of company. And in many cases, the companies that do that do not do commercial insurance as well. So the two that come to mind for me were Lloyd's of London and Travelers Insurance. Both of those companies did the professional liability and general liability for the company. And my insurance broker basically had me fill out a bunch of forms, and he submitted them to both of them, got quotes back, and said, here's the lowest one. Here are the differences between them. Which one do you want? And as you said, you've got this 15-page application, and you're looking at it saying, I don't know what I should be filling out, what I should be saying, what I shouldn't be saying. Realistically, they want you to tell them everything so that they can bump up or down your price based on what it is that you tell them. Because there are certain things that you're going to say that you do, and they're going to say, well, that's a risk. So this is going to cost X additional dollars per month. And there's going to be other things that you mark down. And they're going to say, well, we don't care about that. That's no big deal.
Yeah, we also went through an insurance broker to find this. And at the beginning, I felt a little nervous with the first insurance broker we talked to, because he was asking all questions about whether or not we were going to drive cars around and that kind of stuff. And it turns out that that's the least of our worries. It's all about the electronic data that we've got as a company that's really important to protect.
Yeah, I mean, you can imagine the liability that a company like mine would bring to a company like Symantec, because if I take a customer's database and I put it onto my hard drive and I go home and then I get hacked, well, now I've just taken one of Symantec's customers and I have taken their data and more or less released it into the wild. And it's certainly no fault of theirs. However, they're technically responsible because they're the ones who kind of put me together with that customer. So for them, it's a huge liability. That's something that they really need to address. And that's what this insurance is really geared for. It's for protecting against lawsuits of that type and losses of that type. I think it comes down to just the things that you're trying to protect and the reasons you're trying to protect it. I would assume that, and I'll take a stab in the dark here, Harry, but I would assume that because you have multiple employees, you probably have several months of salary on hand to be able to support those employees for months into the future. And when you get that type of an infrastructure, you've got a customer database, you've got this software out there that is bringing in a reasonably good revenue that is able to support multiple employees, you really need to protect that sort of thing. Whereas Rob's in a bit of a different situation where he basically has to fund himself and, you know, the virtual assistants who help him out in his business. But any one of his sub companies, if you will, is not necessarily large enough in and of itself to warrant that sort of a protection.
And I think even beyond that, it's like, what is the risk of liability? You know, what liability do you really have? And if you look at most of my businesses, they're just very low potential to have some kind of catastrophic failure. Whereas in Harry's business, he has a hosted service that is essentially catering to a bunch of construction companies. And if they went down for a few days, heaven forbid, you could feasibly see him getting pissed off and coming after him. There just seems like there's more potential there for having liability in that.
I think you're right. That's the main reason that this is even on our radar at all, is because we provide this kind of critical business thing. So we do business to business sales. And I think in that situation, we definitely go crazy with our server infrastructure and all that. But it's possible that we could screw up, and we don't want to lose everything on the chance that we do.
If you have a question or comment, call it into our voicemail number at 888-801-9690. Or you can email it in MP3 or text format to questions@startupsfortherestofus.com. Our theme music, it's an excerpt from We're Out of Control by Moot, used under Creative Commons. If you enjoyed this podcast, please consider writing a review in iTunes by searching for Startups, and subscribe to it in iTunes or via RSS at startupsfortherestofus.com. A full transcript of this podcast is available at our website, startupsfortherestofus.com. We'll see you next time.